Why do the heathen rage and the people in Egypt rage? Against the Lord and against his anointed strength. Remember that Joel says the last great in taking counsel against you, even as the Lord. Is to assemble yourselves now, all you need, gather yourselves on the top. My friend Jehoshaphat is not a pleasure. The red orbit has been most more or less continually assaulting while claiming most men making a predominant thought and team their desire to make the retake for most, to which they say they're retaking in the name of the people of China, calling it entirely an internal affair in which we have no business whatsoever. On the other hand, their talks of aggression, sweeping the white man's face to liberate the world, one of the statements of Dallin Ray is that the peoples that are here assembled will represent the strength that will liberate the peoples of the world in the essential. Now, what is liberation? What communism offers to Asia? Now the world watches it. Now this news is pictured in our newspapers by a press that wishes to evaluate a general power as being a defender of America. Trying to silence Dallin Ray from the statements he was making. The actual truth is that he has conferred on several occasions with Dallin Ray, and he's close to being a communist as you can be without ultimately declaring it to the world. But he doesn't want to be involved in a disastrous war which would lay Calcutta and New Delhi to the ground. He doesn't want to become involved in what he's assured would be the retaliatory price of standing in with the communists in an open position. He wants one way to gather the strength in a safe orbit, but at the same time he doesn't want the chances that are involved in this present struggle. But looking to assume the leadership himself in the edge of the field is using personal men to move among the delegates to call for a united front, hoping that the passage of resolutions by 36 nations in assembly, all of them Asiatic or Negro, against us would have a parliamentary effect upon us in the United Nations. We incorporate the United Nations procedure into this conference and seeking by a few ways of structure and balance and by that least common denominator value which has already been discussed as approaching in this June and a more powerful influence than ever in the United Nations. Effectively, last November, we passed through a new crucial era in United Nations history. After that hour, the decisions of all the values in the United Nations would be decided on the basis of the number of people represented or involved. You see that while we've been doing business in the Security Council, that actually the parliamentary procedure would no longer be determined by the veto power of the great nations, but could be determined even now by a least common denominator. More reason why we should immediately withdraw from the thing because of the Corinthians Foundation. Means it might seem if they could form such a bloc over there and then move against all white nations and we control the destiny of everybody in the United Nations on the face of the earth. Now, take this book. Here we have, for the first time, an open assembly of nations taking counsel against us. Best thing that ever happened. So what do you mean? Because it makes a clear line of demarcation. Nobody can ever talk about unity in the United Nations again. Nobody can come along with any propaganda back and try to sell us a bill of goods and say that these things should not be discussed on racial lines. That conference in Bandung is a racial, color line conference against the white race, determining that they're going to do one thing. So last Sunday in the speech, and I was very interested as I read it, out of the headlines of the Morning Examiner in the first edition that hit the streets on Sunday night, the speech of Dallin Ray, he said, we must stand consolidated in our resistance against the white man's imperialism. We must break his bands asunder from all time and throw his yoke from our neck. Now, just think here a minute. I don't believe he reads the song. I don't realize that he knows how clearly he fulfilled this passage. That the heathen will take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed and say, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. If you don't think you are there, if you don't think you are in the day the prophet Joel talked about, this is it. If you doubt that you had proper signs to show your relationship to the plan I create, here it is. Now, frankly, the bombs of the white man is that serum flag when the black plague hit. The bombs of the white man is that food you carry over when suddenly a tidal wave swept out their villages. The bands of the white man are culture, civilization, and assistance, and wisdom. That's the bands of the white man and their superstitious priesthood. Their evil, dark political systems don't want light and brilliance and liberty. They want darkness, and so they resent that. The bands of the white man and the cords of the white man are the light and illumination which he carries into their dark land. They said, we will break them forever. Now there's some news that we have for them. They're not going to break either the band nor the cord. If they assemble themselves against us, the Lord who sits in the highest heaven, who holds the conference and band on in division, but let me tell you this, for the pacifists. For these people that walk around talking, peace, peace, beautiful peace. Let me tell you that you're closer tonight to struggle than you've been in many times since you ended the Korean War. That you didn't send your military advisors to promote it for nothing. We're not pulling strategic personnel out of the various areas and moving their families home for nothing at this moment. Because they now know that there is no question in their minds that Red China will make a move to convince the peoples of Asia that he has the leadership in world affairs and their balance of power is weak. At the same time, she thinks that they do not, without lots of previous evidence, that America would back up without actually coming to grips with the struggle in China. However, some of the most brilliant men we have in our military services have just been briefing the president in Atlanta, Georgia, and Dulles, who can see down there, to side with the military men, and the consensus opinion is revealed in the Washington Post is this, and though that paper stands as a great conservative paper, they said that America, the concept of American military leaders is, in case we have in the defense of Formosa, Lady Matsu and Quimoy, though they're trying to get us to drop that faith, if in event of war, it does not mean a costly expenditure of American lives. For we have no desire to take any territory in Asia, and there's no reason for us to put a single man on the mainland of Asia. So that our attack upon the enemy in the defense of this island will be completely and absolutely punitive. It will be against his bases, his cities, his lines of embarkation, and his centers of power. We don't have to go occupy those territories. We are not fighting a war for territory. We are fighting to destroy an enemy who is trying to take territory. So, under such a proposition, it is not essential that we use a vast amount of American personnel to occupy a land where we could be absorbed by their numbers. And when the Washington Post cites, then it is a political opinion, the military opinion of our great leaders, that we don't have to occupy the land in order to deliver Putin's rule to break their power, to demonstrate that they're thinking in terms of having to take that punitive action. That's where you stand at this moment. Note that outside of Pakistan and the actions of Ronello, only a few among these Mohammedan voices that spoke out were with you, and that the rest of that conference was in the hands of an enemy. And the serious implications of this hour is that these Asian nations, together with African nations, are thinking in complete alignment concerning trying to drive the influences in the primitive of white man's culture back. So we face that as one of the prophetic developments of this week. We cite to you, some people were a little disturbed over the piece that saw in the paper from Senator McCarthy, in which we don't know exactly what he said because we prefer not to read the newspaper. When it said that Senator McCarthy said that that communism and Jewry were not necessarily equated, and that in the statement that is made, he said that it was the technique of the communists to say that communism and Jewry were the same. Question if that's what Senator McCarthy said. He probably said, and more likely said, that a person who didn't have to be a communist because he was a Jew, and that anti-communism was not anti-Semitism, though some Jewish presses interpreted it that way. That's what I imagine he said, because he was at a testimonial dinner for Rabbi Shaw. And if you go to the devil's dinner, you have to at least talk a little bit like you weren't too mad at him. So I imagine that he didn't say anything that his Jewish words were mad. But I don't question that he didn't say over there that it's serious respect for the Jewish people. Call anti-communism, anti-Semitism, because you've been continually reiterating that, and with some foundation, because every time you attack a communist, the Jews say you're anti-Semitic. Of course, if that position that was printed in the paper was the position of Senator McCarthy, I disagree with him. I disagree with anybody who in his thinking diverted from what now becomes a self-established fact. That every Jewish newspaper in the United States, with the exception of the Freeman and Rabbi Schultz's paper, attacked Senator McCarthy because he was anti-communist. Every Jewish newspaper. Now the fact remains that I could supply Senator McCarthy with hundreds of papers published by the Jews in which they berate him and attack him and uphold those he is investigating, which were the rascals. And I think that before there's any group, that in itself would become a guiding factor. However, the only mention had up the press. We say that something that we have changed. We have been calling your attention to these health bills, which were 1158, 1159, 3200 in your assembly on these mental health bills. Now they were postponed for 2 weeks to come from CMO to 2 weeks together. I don't know what action is taking the assembly today on those bills. But it is apparent that they intend to pass the bills. You say, why is that? Because last Saturday, your governor, I don't know who insisted on it, but I know what his face looked like, or at least his nose and ears. But your governor sent an invitation to Saul to come to California to head the new mental hygiene program, which was being passed by the president. Just the way it's stated. I don't know how many of you saw that in the papers. Is any of you sitting there? Several times people read that same thing. No. That demonstrates again the danger of this attempted type of brainwashing that forbids anybody's opinion that is in opposition to the general liberalism trend to take you down the way of socialist Europe. It's an amazing thing that the administrators of these mass psychiatry programs continue to be Jews. And when some Jews, a psychiatrist, tell the governor to invite a top medical man to take possession, who they invite? Another Jew. So, if there is any position held by those that wish to destroy their own society by shutting their eyes against those that discover and continue to call attention to the truth, they'll just have to take it. Because I'm going to tell you that today they try to gather up in this state or in any state those who are mentally sound enough to become aware of issues that goes round about that you're paying attention to. It's going to be the bloodiest day in California history. Because this idea that you can lock up anybody for mental observation and then under Bill 3300 assign him to a mental institution because you don't like what he said. How many do you think of the friends you know that understand the things you do if they got him in for 9 months? How many do you think they release? How many do you think they send to a mental institution? If the Jew psychiatrist has to decide, it's already decided. Whenever they put their hands on your person, when you have violated no law that exercises your privilege of the Bill of Rights to express yourself along facts that you are better informed than your enemy, whenever they can lay hands on your person, they have hit the very foundation of the Constitution, and that's time to deliver ourselves all over again. Because they have no right to lay hands on your person when you have in no way violated any law. There is no law whatsoever against you believing, thinking, and advocating those factors of truth which are vital to your security. With and crucial hours. Let me assure you that the time is speedily coming when these things will come out to you in a great open position. Let me show you how right we are. What I just told you, a rather complete upper echelon of opposition among the great conservatives of our state, assembled under invitation in Hollywood last week several groups of Republican leadership, they heard Governor Lee of state of Utah make a speech. That was last Friday in the city of Los Angeles. And he made a speech on this tax problem, and he made a speech on these growing menaces of socialism, and a speech was delivered at that meeting on this mental hygiene in which those people were told to resist the blood and to fight and with everything at their disposal to block such a thing from coming to pass. They were told that if this goes through and they start to enforce it, then it is a struggle for survival. So you see no rest in assembly. Then the so-called sophisticated center of the conservative element, which were gathered at that meeting, determined that this was designed for one reason or another, and that was to incarcerate the people that were for sure. Now, let me start this. There were just so many people. I know how many people are represented there. And I know the groups they represent. There's too many of you. There's too many of you, and the enemy would find that out. And the strange thing is, these mental health clinics are just another diabolical scheme of the enemy to remove all opposition, and they want to do it before June when they're trying to pass into this world government proposition. Now we move into another phase of development. With this world conference assembled against you, the mark of its attack being leveled against you, and you climactically moving into an important position, the position of opposing that your Secretary of State said, that if they make an introduction to the United Nations, any program which interferes with the security of the United States, America will pay no consideration to it whatsoever. would force this man Stevenson, who still considers himself the title head of the Democratic Party, to say that America should go along with such decisions if it is going to assume the respect of nations and an organization in which it participates. So now we have Stevenson, the title head of the Democratic Party, with Dulles in opposition, Dulles saying if they try to shake the fist at us, we'll get out. Now that's the first time we've heard anything official out of the State Department going along with the position which was also expressed this week by Senator Nolan. Senator Nolan in U.S. News answered Stevenson's speech, and he said that the policy of these people all that oppose the opposition to communism or oppose any direct action, he says, is nothing but appeasement. So Senator Nolan says they continually want to get world peace by giving something away. Now they want to give away Queen Moy and Matt Stu and shake all confidence that anybody might have in any concern in our leadership. And he says, after you give that away, you give it away on the assurance of the Reds, Mr. Stevenson said, that they're not going to try to take Formosa now, but will look for a peaceful solution. Well, he said, they just finished in Bandung this week saying that they're going to take it by force. How then could we predicate anything apart from their words on an expectation of a peaceful solution? He said, we should take a firm line now. We should draw the line against communism. And then Senator Nolan came out with a historic statement. He said, I'm tired of two of anything, one half of it's evil. He says, I don't want to see two Americas, someday half of it split, the other half fighting from Hawaiian Islands or for Alaska to try to regain our mainland. I don't like two Koreas. I don't want to sabotage Kai-shek, who's our ally from the beginning, and I don't believe in two Chinas. He said, it is my conviction that until we are determined that there will be one China under the true government, and one Korea under the true government, and one Germany under the German people, that we have not fulfilled our mission. So when we get around to that, I turn to something else which is important, which lays the premise for the things we're going to discuss. You know what your enemy fears more than anything else? He fears your faith in a mission. More than any one other thing, your enemy fears your faith in a mission. This week you will find, right in U.S. News and just releasing a new book, Walter Lippmann writes a book, and he writes two sections of it, two books. Now, there is more opinion that he's a Jew, he may well be, but the fact remains he writes like one. But the thing I want to say is that it is the important thing to you what Walter Lippmann says, because given coverage in U.S. News, there's going to be over 500,000 Americans read it, who read and think in terms of world opinion and situation. Now, I would analyze this. The man did not have enough creative genius to find a title for his book number one that somebody else had not used. Book number one is called The Decline of the West. Where did the name come from? It came from a philosopher who knows more than Whitman will ever know. It came from Oswald Spengler, who wrote the first book, Decline of the West. Now Walter Lippmann even cribs a little bit of the material and rewrites it and changes it and then adds some of his own thinking as he evaluates what has happened to nations in the decline of the West. Book number two is called The Public Philosophy, or The People's Philosophy. So in these two books, he outlines what he hopes will be an adopted concept among the sophisticated liberal of our time. Number one, he talks about the revolution, and how revolutions for liberty seem to break out, and how we watch this nation formed, he said, out of a revolution. And he said that at the same time France was being formed out of a revolution, he tries to make it a Jacobin revolution in which men struck for liberty, individual and personal. Then he said, the thing that was disastrous about this, that Americans striking for liberty, actually, he said, were striking for it along a divine mission line, with a Puritan approach, the people of God idea. And he said that ultimately, as the Puritan element breaks out of our culture, our society finds that it's based individual liberty on such foundations are now no longer substantial, and we must go to stronger central government. And he cites that all over the world, individual liberty and democracy is such, so we were never a democracy, we were always a republic. From the very hour of our inception to that, we were a republic. Prior to that, we were colonies with a certain amount of self-determination, and only when that was infringed upon did we go into revolution. However, in his interpretation, this is what he said. He said, these nations, he said, around the world, that are limited monarchy are remaining strong, but all democracies are weak and even declining. So he said there is several things that I see he is responsible for. In the first place, he said, there are certain things we must curb. And then comes the punchline. He said, we must realize that politicians can say what they please, and people get up under the guise of civil liberties and free speech, and they say anything they want to. He said, just as a man shouting fire in a theater is dangerous, so also is the man who on the platform denounces communism or denounces the Jews or denounces anybody else. He said, that person is dangerous. He said, remember, he says that we're fighting, there's a struggle between communism and fascism. And he says, the lie is a deadly thing. He says, people should not have the right to say what they believe if it's wrong from the platform and not immediately be liable to slander because it was a group and not an individual they talked against. In other words, he said, if they libel an individual, they'd be sued for slander. He says, but he says, libeling a group or saying something wrong about a world organization and they get away with it. He says, now he says, we must realize that these people spread their ideas like fire. And therefore, we must be able to control the person who gets up and speaks and not permit him free speech unless he can scientifically prove every point he thinks. Well, opinion would go away. The whole structure of our free speech would pass away. Now he says that's the cause of it. Now he says there's a public morality and a people's philosophy, and it's the most important thing. It doesn't make a difference what race, line, creed, culture it is. He says that should be the important thing to determine the new great brave world if it's to emerge as such, and that's people's philosophy and people's morality. And so he said, therefore, everything should be proven. He said, how and what protection have the public against a speaker that can influence a lot of people that listen to him? Because nobody gets the truth. They don't get it out of the newspapers because they just get the opinions they want them to have. And they don't get it from the platform. They just get the opinions somebody else wants them to have. Therefore, elections are not any good because somebody persuades them. And the election doesn't necessarily determine the opinion of the people. Well, a certain amount of truth is welded into the story. But when you get through, he's fighting against everything that you and I believe in. If America made a mistake at the elections last time, they got plenty of time to rectify it the next election as the people realize this factor. But if you take away from the people the right of voting and the right of free speech because you say they don't know how to use it, or you limit everybody who has scientific, documented evidence of every statement he makes and throw him in jail is dangerous, and then, my friends, you have accomplished what the Jew would like to do, silence the opposition. So here we have this picture of Whitman's philosophy. But the thing I want to premise his remarks, he said, the most dangerous thing, you know what it is? He says, now he says that the demagogues, the totalitarians, the politicians, or those that oppose them, each one has believes he's right. They've already convinced themselves that they are. He said, one of the most deadly things against the people's philosophy is a concept of a heavenly mission. He said we must separate the church and state, but the church and state should go along on the things which are right, and they should suppress or oppose that which is wrong, and it's wrong to try to bring the things of heaven down to earth. Well, my friends, that's the only thing you're here for, and that's all you've been taught to say, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. So he calls you and I dangerous, curious, millennialists. And he said that the people that believe the writings of John in the book of Revelation are working for a millennium on earth. And that's a dangerous thing because he says they marched right off and conquer the world in the name of a millennium and bringing heaven to earth. Well, that's too bad. I can understand why Mr. Whitman might not like to see people believe the book of Revelation and then start operating like they believe it. Because you see, the idea that you can separate true leadership in the world from a divine mission is a fallacy. Because everything that develops in the kingdom of God develops out of his vision and out of his inspiration and will develop according to ultimately to his blueprint, and his kingdom is going to perform and do the thing which he said it's going to do. Now, there may be a public philosophy, but it's embraced the United Nations. There may be a public philosophy, but it doesn't seem to repudiate Buddha or Hinduism. So we can't take a least common denominator of the nations of the world and find a standard of common morality or find a standard of common theology. There isn't a common theology, and there isn't a common morality. In fact,
A long time ago, Father Baldwin, who wrote a tremendous piece on philosophy, which, again, Mr. Whitman likes to quote just a little part, he said that there isn't a common morality, there is a right and a wrong. But Mr. Whitman said that that's a narrow position of a deist. Let me tell you, I'd rather be a deist in God's universe than to be an agnostic who's working on a material foundation with nothing to work with. So what is the element with which we are faced? The enemy are gathering and take counsel against us. We are in the historic year of 1955. We are on the edge of the most important things of all time and period. And yet I tell you that the secret of this lies in a certain element. An element that, while present in everything, has no direction or form as it relates to vision or incentive except among a certain people. Now, when we mentioned, or the title was given of the glory of God, we wanted to talk to you for a few minutes about a rather primordial substance, a substance that's more elemental than the elements which are comprised of it, a substance which, because of what it is, only takes its form according to its ability. What every element of your universe is made of, vibrations of electricity moving on a direction according to a pattern of law. These we know as the electrons, the protons, the neutrons, the mentoids that move in the structure of your atom. We see around the substances, all of which are the demonstration of a mind which ordained that they would take form and they would be there to do their work. But there are something more than this. The words which we see repeated by Paul, or stated by Paul, that all things referring to Christ were made by him, without him was not anything made that was made. All things exist by him and through him, and by him all things consist. Thus, everything that exists in the universe exists out of a wavelength of energy and vibration that moves out of the great creative mind of the Most High God. Now, that includes the sidereal systems, it includes all the created beings and races, even those who are your opponents. But that is, and you say, what is that substance? Well, that substance is the primeval energy, primordial energy that moved out of God. Now, look at this. We talked to you 2 weeks ago on the resurrection, and on the crucifixion and resurrection, and last week we talked to you about the universality in your race, among white men everywhere, from the days of Adam and Job on down the resurrection. And the evidence of it, and the fact that every chaplain that ever consigned in military history a body to the sea or to the ground did till resurrection day. That every minister of every denomination in the memorial service, in the funeral parlor, or at the graveside consigned them to the resurrection. Now we cite to you that there's another facet out of this which we would call your attention to. You remember after his resurrection, when Christ was walking on the road to Emmaus with two of the disciples, and it said two disciples were walking on the road to Emmaus, and they were conversing together concerning the things that happened when a stranger approached them. And we read the record here in the Gospel of Luke that when the stranger approached them, they were walking together, and they said, "Why are you cast down? What seems to trouble you?" And they said, "Why, you must be a stranger in Palestine. Haven't you heard about Jesus of Nazareth, a prophet who voiced the word of God, and we hope would be the Messiah of Israel, and how the chief priests and the elders took him and crucified him? And we had hoped that he would be the Messiah." Jesus walked along with them, and they didn't know it. Finally, he said, "O thou of little wisdom," translated, "thou fool, how slow art thou to believe all that is written of the prophets? Should not Christ have suffered all these things and entered into his glory?" Now note this. This is an important key. It says here, "Ought not Christ to have suffered these things and enter into his glory?" Now you're a deist, so you might as well go all the way. If God created the heavens and earth, if he's the master of the universe, if he's the ordainer of destiny, if he's the one who finishes and completes, then he, by his own admission, is utterly responsible and accountable for the whole vastness of his universe, even if an archangel wouldn't fly. Therefore, nobody else could have redeemed his people, set them free, empowered his people, or restored anything to them. No one else could accomplish this but God. So now, not shirking any of the responsibility, here is God walking down the road with two men and they don't know. Now, what does God say? Does he say, when they talk about the crucifixion, my, how terrible this is, and this should never have been done to Christ? He turns suddenly and says, shouldn't God the Messiah do this? Isn't he the responsible one in his universe? Isn't he accountable for all these controls? Shouldn't he have done this? And after all, shouldn't the Messiah get his own glory back? Now you say, what is he talking about? The most important thing you can find out about in the 20th century, getting the glory back. When you have learned how to get that back, or when you receive back that glory, even as he wanted to get back his own glory, you'll discover what is going to transform the age. Let me tell you this. In the 17th chapter of John, we have one of those amazing prayers in which God enveloped in the body of a man. As you have read, and we have read to you in the second chapter of Hebrews, we'll take the time to read to you tonight, but ask you to read again in meditation on it when you get home. That you, man, made just a little lower than the angels, made with all power given unto you, though we see now you're not holding all this power because of a violation of law, that God himself, the eternal Christ, when he was born, desired to be born out of your race, that he might call you brethren and kindred, and therefore assumed a position in your society like you, just a little lower than the angels. Now what does it mean? Just this, that not that he lacked the power to be greater, but that he had left something that angels had. He had left off the glory of his immortality. Now you see, if he had carried his immortality with him, when he was born of the Virgin Mary, though he was very God from an Immaculate Conception, had he carried his immortality with him, they never could have crucified him. Couldn't put something to death that can't die. And if you couldn't crucify him, you could never have an atonement. And you would never have a rectification. So therefore, the man Christ Jesus, being the very body of God, who the fullness of God dwelt bodily, left the aura and essence of his spirit, remain in the dimensions of spirit, invisible to the naked eye, but still around. And therefore, the immortal portion of his being was left around him, above him, but not on him. For this cause, we read the 17th chapter of John. And you may follow what this says, because it's important. In the 17th chapter of John, Jesus is praying. And this is what he said. Agra Numas, creating spirit, translated Father, the hour is come. Now there's just one thing he wanted. Glorify the Son, that the Son, or the incarnate body, might glorify thee. As thou hast given this body of flesh power over all flesh, that he might give eternal life to as many as thou hast given him. Know again the divine order. Therefore, he says, this is life eternal, that they might know the true God and the body of God. I have glorified thy spirit on earth. I have finished the work thou gavest to do. Now, O created spirit, there's just one thing I want. Glorify me with thine own self, with the glory I had in thee before the world was. Now, catch this for a moment. Here is the man Christ Jesus, knowing all things, perceiving all things, lost none of his wisdom with omniscience, had all power over everything before him, except that he had left his glory, which is an effulgent energy, a vibrant power which puts together every atom of the being. He had left that effulgent glory belonging to his celestial nature off of his physical body. So he said, there's just one thing I'd like, just for a few moments, one thing, just glorify me with the glory I had when I was in thee, enveloped in this glory before the world was. Peter, James, and John, on the Mount of Transfiguration, for just one moment, saw something brighter than the sun. They saw Christ suddenly enveloped in a glory that made him translucent and radiant, that so filled them and challenged them they didn't want to leave. Now remember that he said, I just want that one thing now, to be covered with that glory. Now there is no question that there is no more powerful symbol of energy and force. There is no greater essence of life and immortality than that emanation referred to as the glory of God. Primordial substance. It's energy, it's vibration, it's power, it's light, it has form. But listen. One day Isaiah writes and says that he remembers the exact day, and in his writing he said, it was in the years of the king Uzziah when I saw the Lord. And he said, I went into the temple and he was high and lifted up and above the sanctuary. And it was as though his throne were set in the air above the sanctuary of the temple. And the radiation, the emanation, the glory filled the place like a train. And he said, round about, he could hear the voices of the seraphim saying, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. And he heard it said, and the earth is to be full of thy glory. Now, what is glory? Glory is more than just the illumination, which is the emanation of it. It is an energy that puts things together and is an energy that holds things in their proper form, that moves out of the very person of God. Now, remember this. There is only one race on the face of the earth. Mr. Whitman may not like this. There are a lot of people around the world who don't like it. They don't like it tonight in Van Dunn. But there's only one people on the face of the earth that were born with His glory, who were started as a race with it, who, while they lost it, still have it imputed to them until the restoration of it, who still have a part of it with them ever since the atonement was consummated in Calvary. Listen to what it says. I carry you back into Isaiah, and we read concerning the purpose of the Lord. And He says here, concerning the house of Israel, the people of God, He says, "This is the one thing that I would say unto you, the Lord which is mighty. In that day the Lord of hosts shall be a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty on all that remain of His people. When the spirit of His judgment stretches forth, and He sits in judgment, and the strength of her people of God are the gates of civilization in the earth, the gates of power and majesty and righteousness. But His glory is thy diadem." Now in this emanation of radiation of life, this is what He said: "I am the Lord, this is my name, I am Yahweh. And my glory I am not going to give to another, only belongs to my family. I'll not give it to another, neither will I prefer my praise to graven images, nor will it go out upon any other." Now while we're still in Isaiah, I want you to listen to what He said. "Arise now, Israel, my kingdom, my people, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee." But I won't give it to another. I'm not going to let another race have it, but my glory is on thee. Therefore, that emanation, divine energy, that substance which is the creative power in the universe, that creates creative vision, that ultimately is the power that raises the very dead, that glory belongs unto the kingdom of God. It belongs unto a race that is out of here. It's a light, it's an emanation, it's a glow. And the Most High said, "This is my glory, I have it, I'm going to give it to you." We mentioned to you about how Sennacherib was one of the greatest evidences of the danger of attacking the house of God, and how the British Museum story is still there. He said, "We were afraid to attack by night because there was a glow of the presence of the God of Israel that hovered over the camp for a perimeter almost a mile round about, and it was easier to attack in the daytime because if they tried to attack at night, they stepped out of the darkness to the light. It was easier to see them in the nighttime stepping into the light than it was in the daytime when it was all light." What was that? That was a Shekinah glory, the Old Testament tells us. What is it? That means an emanation, an effulgent energy moving out of God, just covering the people. And don't you think that a certain amount of it wasn't being absorbed by the people below? Remember when you went out of the land of Egypt, that effulgent glory hovered over the people. In fact, when they built the temple of Solomon, it again was in the Holy of Holies as it was in the tabernacle. A radiation, an effulgent glow. It was called the glory of God. But it was the covering of divine presence which belonged to all the sons of God and which had to be restored to them. Now you say, what has this to do? Just this, that it is the light of thy kingdom. It is this light which is descending upon you to produce spiritual vision. It is this power which God is making manifest, which is His own nature, enveloping you, that the enemy doesn't like. More than that, it is your assurance that the right and the life and the destiny of God's kingdom is going to be made manifest. Listen, that kingdom is going to take over the world, whether the world likes it or not. The enemy writes, or the philosopher trying to pose as the new thought writes, he says, this idea that we have a divine mission and we're going to carry it out, whether the people on the receiving end like it or not, is all wrong. Well, my friends, let me tell you something. It doesn't make a difference whether he likes it or not either. It is the mission which God Almighty gave to His kingdom. You're going to move out with the glory of God upon you, rising upon you with life and with power, and that which Christ laid down in order that He might finish that work for you was His glory, that they might crucify. Now, what did Jesus say to the two men walking down the road? Now, shouldn't Christ have finished the work that He came to do? Shouldn't He have done the things He did? And to get back His glory. That's the important thing. The important thing was Christ had to be crucified to get His glory back. And He got it back. When He got it back, He shook the foundations of the grave, and He shook them for all time. In fact, He was so filled with that glory that He said to Mary when she met Him there in the garden, "Don't touch me. This energy hasn't passed off, but you couldn't touch me." Let me tell you that there is more involved in that pattern than you have any idea. the Apostle Paul talking about this climactic day when we're going to see the revelation of the sons of God makes this important statement. He says, I don't even reckon the sufferings and the problems, the things I have to go through at this present time, that worthy to be compared with the glory which I shall receive in the day when the manifestation of the sons of God takes place. What was he talking about? He was talking about an effulgent light and energy of power of God-likeness that would come down upon him that would make him indestructible. Don't make it impossible for one portion of his tissue to break down, but make it impossible for anything to be dissolved. Because that's the life, it's the light of man, it's the light that holds all things together. Only when directed upon those with whom it has an affinity, it will give them a kind of immortality promised in restoration to the Adamic race. Now we cite that this is an important development, because in this which was anticipated and expected, God said, I'm going to put my glory, nobody else will I give it to, but I'm going to put it back on my family, on my household, and on my people. And in the hour of that glory, when it is made manifest, it is going to be power of even as Sennacherib was afraid. If you don't think that that's in the offing, let me tell you this. Over here in the book of Isaiah, I read these words. And Isaiah speaks concerning these climactic hours, and he says, the loftiness of the enemies will be bowed down, the haughtiness of these men will be made low. The Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. The idols he shall abolish. And they that go on, that worship these idols, shall run to the holes of the rocks and to the caves of the earth for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth, when his glory shall be seen upon thee like a diadem. They're going to run that day. And in this second chapter of Isaiah, he declares that these heathen that now gather together against you, every last one of them got an idol stuck away somewhere except the Mohammedans. All of them are worshiping devils and idols. The Lord said, when I get through shaking the earth. You don't think he's shaking the earth? Remember what we said to you a week ago, talking about how the earthquakes came in cycles? We said it went over now into Mongolia, and it would go farther into China. Then you'd watch it in Greece. And then it would go from into Crete and Greece, in that area. And then it would resolve its way again westward. Well, the Palestinian-Greek line has been on the line for the last few days, and another one in Athens today. And it's shaking along those lines. It's about 37 degrees a day. It's progressive. The Lord's shaking the earth. And in the day he shakes the earth, in the day of all these signs, there's more in it than men realize. There's a sifting in it, and it's sinewing and shaking. Let me tell you, the glory of God is starting to move upon his people in a greater way than they realize. For in this day, when the heathen gather together, the latter rain is to descend of energy, power, light, illumination. Turn over here to the New World Order. The book of Revelation tells us about the New World Order, the New Jerusalem, the New World Order in the midst of the earth. I call this to your attention then. The day when death is conquered. The climax of an age when there's no tears, no crying, no death, no pain. But a world order that's occupying the earth. And it says, and I saw this world order, this great continuing city, this bride, the Lamb's wife, having the glory of God. Now think, the glory of God, that primordial substance, that wavelength of light, vitality, and energy that gives immortality. Having the glory of who? The glory of God. Now, who's the city? It's Israel. Because he wouldn't give it to anybody else. He's already said he wasn't going to. He said, only one people, only one household, my sons, my daughters, have the capacity to receive this light, this power, this glory. Now, remember this. We've talked to you before about how Moses approached the burning bush, how he had to take his shoes off so he could ground himself in the tremendous energies and vibrations that move down to divine presence, and how in the course of that hour, his constant association with God on numerous occasions had immunized him more and more till he came to that experience on the mountain where the law was given. And when he got up on top of that mountain, though the glory of God enveloped God, he still couldn't look on his face. He just looked on the back of God in the clouds. But the glory was so great that the face and the countenance and the body of Moses emanated with that glory. In fact, there was so much radiation. You talk about it, radiation, the universe put together with it. What we first put together was the glory, the power, and the purpose. And in that hour, that anyone that touched that mountain would have been injured, or would have been injured by the very power of it, and they would have been put to death because they couldn't whisper. Over here in the book of Corinthians, we read these words. Now, when Moses went up on that mountain, we are able ministers of a new covenant. But if that administration, which still had judgment in it, which was carved into those stones when Moses got it on the mountain, if the transmission of that truth was so great that while law with chastisement and judgment and death still written into it was so important that Moses so radiated with divine glory and emanation, when he came down off the mountain, he had to put a veil around his face because they couldn't look on his countenance and live. Now think that over. That's an energy and power that if you had it on you today, every rascal would run out of America. If the glory of God became visible, I believe it's coming. I believe part of it's there. I believe a lot of the glory of God's on you already. It's demonstrated in vision, technology, achievement. But if the glory of God was made manifest, if they could see, if the order of spirit resting on each one of you suddenly became visible with invisible rain, if there was a rascal in here, he'd be breaking through the door. Now let me tell you, my friends, that the glory of God is going to shine, and the Lord says, we're going to hunt the caves and the holes of the mountains. Because of the fear of that emanation. Remember, Sennacherib wasn't a little fellow. Sennacherib's armies were as powerful as could come out of the Assyrians of his day. But he says, I'm not going to attack at night because I can see the glory. In the daytime, it doesn't bother me so much, but I'm not going to step into that light at night. The modern Canaanite and Assyrian can't stand the light. He just hasn't the ability, as Jesus said, to understand or perceive, because the light's not there, the glory's not there, the illumination that gives him the power. So Jesus said, you can't understand the speech because you can't hear the word. You could hear the audio frequency, you could hear the sound vibration, but he didn't have that spiritual capacity to perceive with him. Therefore, if what Moses received was an important thing, ready it with glory. The Most High said that you that have the laws, now where are they? He's got the law. The law's not abolished. He's just made alive. The only thing that was taken away was the curses. If you had all the curses, if Israel had all the curses, it wouldn't be any of us left. But he took those curses away. The handwriting of it, he blotted out. The handwriting of those ordinances were against you. And he gave you a new covenant. He fulfilled a prophecy in Jeremiah and reiterated again in the book of Hebrews, in which he says, I will write my laws in your heart, and I will put it in your mind. And I will activate you with a responsibility, a very conscience, that is in affinity with God. The result is that if those laws on that mountain were glorious, then if you could behold the image of the Lord, as though you were looking in a looking glass, and then behold your image alongside of it, with each new wave of truth, with each new pulsing concept, you would discover that you were being changed, if you could see it, from glory to glory. So in other words, the creative transition going on in your society is a great chain of divine energy, sometimes visible, sometimes not visible, but if you could see as in a glass, looking at the image of the Lord, you would discover that you, the children of God, were being transformed with glory after glory until you have as much power as He has on earth. Now let me tell you why this is important. Because it tells you in Romans that He predestinated you to conform to the image of His Son. That He intended the children of His kingdom have restored to them by the climax of this age all the glory, all the power, all the creative force, and all the victorious power that He possessed in the hour of His resurrection. He the first fruit. And at the hour of His coming, that development not yet consummated is going to take place in the twinkling of an eye, and every individual will be changed in the elements of His being. Now I tell you, if you're in such an hour, it's not going to be too long before you hear a trump. Not going to be too long before the enemy masses, he's going to get the surprise of his life. The God of the earth says, I'm going to fight for you just like I fought for your forefathers, with shaking earth and quivering earth and volcanoes and eruptions and activities, all for you.
The armies gather and the heathen take counsel together. You are in a climactic hour when there shall descend on you like rain, again an emanation of Shekinah glory, which will be seen upon you, even that your enemies will be noticed. Will cover your land as it did in the days of the Exodus. Will be a symbol again of the nation where the Lord is the light thereof. And upon you His sons and upon His daughters. This is one of those mysterious things that we've been talking about for 2,000 years. People talk about the glory of the Lord. Oh, the glory of the Lord. What is the glory of the Lord? It is energy, effulgent life power that connects your celestial being and your physical body and makes you deathless. Power that can do all things. Power that makes you master of every element of the earth, that restores to you the dominion that belonged to Adam in the hours of his creation. Now, what do you do with it? You go out and put the earth in order. You make them obey. You bring them in confirmation of divine law, and you cut down the idol temples. Now they say, well, that's a heavenly mission. No wonder Mr. Richmond doesn't like that. No wonder these people that are in contest against you don't want it. No wonder Walter Whitman doesn't want it. Why? Because, my friends, when the children of God, who are the sons of God, who are the disciples of Christ,
established in completion the kingdom which he ordained they were to put together, there's going to be no sharing of that administration with the sons of Satan. You know the only time you have to back up and take water? You know the only time you have to change? The only time you have to cut off the corners of what you say? Is when you're in the association seated down at dinner with the enemy. If you want to know where not to be, don't go to a Jewish synagogue. If you want to know where not to be, don't sit down with a bunch of them around the table. That's where you lose your freedom. Come out and be separate, but don't change nor veer one iota on the truth. Let every man be against you, that God be true. But know this, you have absolute power in the earth. Is there anything to be afraid of with all the plots and all the conspiracies? The only thing that I tell you to be afraid of is fear. The only people that Satan has defeated that I know about are those who are afraid. The only people, even on our side right, who I watched folded up, stopped, put out of business, closed up, are those that were afraid. Let me tell you that you have a scepter of power, and you're soon going to be crowned with glory and with honor. And so that is the essence of this text. Lest let the heathen be divided from us. Let them take counsel together. The Lord says, I hold them in derision. Why? Because I'm about to visit my people with glory and with honor. We got a peculiar idea that glory is just praise. We got an idea that glory is just is a little halo. Let me tell you, glory makes you brighter than the sun. Remember what the enemy said about Jesus at the hour of his resurrection when he had his glory on? He said, it was like Jupiter emerging, brighter than the sun, and we fell to the ground like dead men. What does he say? He said, you shall move with the emanation of that glory which belongs to you until you don't need a sun or moon, because the Lord in you is the light thereof. What's that? Now, it isn't important whether Mr. Whitman or any of the others like deism. It isn't important whether they like the heavenly mission. Because, you see, this is our Father's world, and we who perceive this heavenly mission are going to occupy the earth. That's why they're afraid of it. They're trying to talk us out of it. They're trying to tell us the giants are too great. We can't do it. And the world will accept it. They don't make any difference whether they accept it. They'll accept it someday because every knee's going to bow. Then, my friends, there'll be peace in the earth. Not in fear. So we tell you tonight that thus saith the Lord, they may not lie, but they have not found a way inside of the kingdom of God to tear up this book. Remember that. They did behind the Iron Curtain. That's the reason why they tore the Bible up, wherever the communist came in, the liberal comes in, the socialist comes in. Why? He is afraid of thus saith the Lord. And he thinks that he can tear up the book, and that will remove its content. But the thing that he's afraid of, which he's fighting tonight, is the prophecies in it. Thus he says, the danger of those who believe in the content of Revelation and are trying to bring a millennium on earth. Well, don't worry, my friend. Just arm yourselves with the revelation. And thy kingdom come if you and I assume the throne. For the sons of God with glory are going to sit in the seats of administration. This isn't just a theory. This is something that's working. The evidence each passing day, now the heathen taking counsel together, disprove how accurate the blueprint is. Let me tell you that one of the best evidences that you're right is that your enemy is considering you and your opinion. Just remember that. If you were not a formidable force in which he was trying to cap, your opinions wouldn't be worth his discussion. But when he discusses the problem of trying to stop the people that are trying to take over the world because it's divine destiny and they want to do it in the name of their God to build a millennium on earth, then, my friend, when they start discussing that, it shows you that they're worried about you coming to the perimeter of the mark. So there's a new age, Lord. The day of light, the day of glory. The day when you are going to be as radiant as the spectacle that Isaiah saw when he said, in that year, the king was eyes of the throne, I saw the Lord mighty and lifted up in his holy temple. So I lifted up above the sanctuary, and I felt a substance emanating from him like a train filling the temple. And I heard the voices say that this glory, this emanation, this great light was going to cover the earth. Why? Because you're the carriers of it. There's no other light carriers on the face of the earth than children born with it. The wavelength of your spirit is exactly the same as the wavelength of the Spirit of God. Scientific Digest comes out with a little thing which, of course, he talks about in his scientific publication. And just one phase of it intrigues me tonight to get. Reiterates what But of course, the statement is, it's found on the little side of the Digest this month again. It's on the photography of those plant leaves. They've been talking about it now other periodicals are picking that up. Photograph the plant leaves. And as it turns back towards the plant, or gets to one place where effulgent light hovers over the leaf. When it gets in relationship to the main plant, when its entire branch structure, twig structure points to the main plant, it photographs with a halo. Let me tell you something. He says, I am the vine and you are the branch. And when you get in relationship with the plant, then comes the radiation of the halo. They don't like it. They like to turn it off. Let me say that the branch only produces fruit when it's dividing in the vine, when it's lined up with it. And that divine alignment is the thing that God's doing with his people now. He's lining them up with the main branch. He said, if I can look it up, I draw all Adamites unto me, all men. Turn to the being that couldn't accept him. It says, you believe not because you're not with me. But nevertheless, if I be lifted up, I draw all men unto me. And when they're in line, they're going to call us to God. For he who is the Son of Righteousness will empower them with us, whoever they are. Because that's the law of life and the law of sameness and substance, even in the living plant and the living tree.
The talk you have just heard was given by Dr. Swift in 1955 in April, entitled The Glory of God. The first part of the talk, in reference to things occurring at that time, seemed a little bit out of place perhaps, and yet look around us today and find the ongoing of all of the ills we had at that very time. Surely, God is not mocked. Everything that he has determined will come to pass, and we are living in Bible times. I trust you will keep Lorraine in your prayers, and until we talk to you again via the tape ministry, we say goodbye, and may God richly bless you.